You're listening to the teaching ministry of Houston's First Baptist Church, a relevant biblical community. For more information, visit houstonsfirst.org. Here's Pastor Greg Mott.
Last week, Pastor Greg launched a series, a three-sermon series called The Hereafter from John chapter 11. So if you would turn there, he began with Lazarus. Next Sunday, he'll end with Lazarus. But today, he wanted me to finish, starting in verse 45, the last part of chapter 11. I've entitled it Death Sentence, and I told someone after the first service, it's kind of hard to get a lot of enthusiasm once you announce the topic. I mean, it's almost kind of a non-starter, you know, death sentence. But we see here that Jesus became so popular after the raising of Lazarus that the Sanhedrin, the Sadducees, the Pharisees felt like he was going to take over the whole nation. And they literally put a death sentence on Jesus Christ. We as humans have a death sentence on us. The Bible says the wages of sin is death. It's like the funeral home director that signed all of his letters, eventually yours. We don't like to admit it. But we have a death sentence on us as well. So look at the treachery that you see, the plot and counterplot that we see, and the whole theme of death, the theme of the hereafter that you see in John chapter 11, beginning in verse 45. Let's stand in honor of reading God's word from the New International Version. Therefore, many of the Jews who had come to visit Mary and had seen what Jesus did put their faith in him. But some of them went to the Pharisees and told them what Jesus had done. Then the chief priests and the Pharisees called a meeting of the Sanhedrin. What are we accomplishing, they ask. Here is this man performing many miraculous signs. Notice this statement. If we let him go on like this, everyone will believe in him. Then the Romans will come and take away our place, both our place and our nation. Then one of them named Caiaphas, who was high priest that year, spoke up and said, you know nothing at all. You do not realize that it is better for you that one man die for the people than that the whole nation perish. He did not say this on his own, but as high priest that year, he prophesied that Jesus would die for the Jewish nation. And not only for that nation, but also for the scattered children of God, to bring them together and to make them one. So from that day on, they plotted to take his life. You may be seated and may God honor the reading of his word. John has 21 chapters. We're just in chapter 11. But if you look at chapter 12, it's already the triumphal entry. And the last 10 chapters of John are devoted to that last week in the life of Jesus Christ. So at this point, we have a foreshadowing that the Sanhedrin plots to kill Jesus. And we know the end of that story, that he was crucified. It seemed that it totally took the disciples by surprise. You remember after the crucifixion, dispirited, scattered. Peter said, I want to go back to fishing. Even when the women came and told the 11 disciples, he's risen. Luke records that they looked at the women like they were talking nonsense. How did the disciples miss it so badly? The historian Luke records in meticulous detail three separate incidents where Jesus told his disciples, I will be betrayed, I will be arrested, I will be tried, I will die, and then 3 days later I will rise again. Why did they get it so badly? Why did they not get it at all? It's because, especially when sudden death strikes, we tend to look more on circumstances than we do on the promises of God. And I think that's the failure of all of us. When grief sweeps over us like a tidal wave, we have to claim the promises of God. In your listening guide, the very first blank is, the unexpected death of a loved one is life's ultimate shock. I think Pastor Greg called it last week a punch in the gut. And it really is. You see, the disciples saw Jesus and his popularity. Said many of the Jews believed in him. The Sanhedrin felt like the whole nation was going to turn to him. And isn't that an interesting thought historically? What if the Sanhedrin had backed off? Jesus, the whole nation had turned to Jesus. But we know that's not that was not to be. But it's interesting to think what might have been. The disciples saw the whole nation turning to Jesus. They saw a man in the prime of his life. Never a sick day in his life. And by the way, he is Jesus. If he gets sick, he can heal himself. And then they had their hopes placed on an earthly kingdom. In Matthew, he records that the mother of James and John came to Jesus and said, when you come into your kingdom, we want one son to sit on your left, one son to sit on your right. We want to be the president and the vice president, the premier and the leader of your new government. We know at least one of his disciples was a zealot. And the zealots advocated the violent overthrow of the Romans and the establishment of a Jewish state. And so we know that they kind of had their hopes pinned on an earthly kingdom. They mistook the nature of Jesus' discipleship, messiahship, and his claim upon them. And isn't that a problem that we have? Don't we kind of put Jesus into a neat little compartment and say, Jesus, this is the reign you have over my life. And when we begin to feel like maybe he wants more than that, that there's something more to this, we kind of put boundaries up and say, no more. But you see, the next blank, death breaks into our lives. It reminds us of our own mortality. And it establishes that we are not in control. We're not in control. We want to pretend that we're in control. Houston's the air conditioning capital of the world. We go to this little knob on the wall, and we think we're in control. We think we can determine the weather. And then all of a sudden, your condenser goes out, or the power goes out, and you realize, oh, I'm so upset, I'm bitter. No, you know, this is reality. 95 degree temperature, 98 degree humidity, that's reality in Houston. All you're doing is trying to control your reality. And ultimately, we cannot control reality. Jesus said, in this life, you will have trouble. Death breaks into our lives, reminds us of our own mortality, and reminds us that we are not in control. We try to erect walls. We try to have walls of security around us and our family. And death absolutely shocks us. And when we come to that moment of shock, oftentimes we're looking at circumstance rather than the promises of God. Tornadoes have really been in the news lately, as Ryan mentioned. And I have to say, the other night, I was actually getting physically sick to my stomach watching the news because they were talking about tornadoes moving into the Oklahoma City area. And it just really brought back bad memories for me. There was that night in 1999 when my brother called me. He said, David, a monster tornado is literally bearing down on our parents' house in Del City, Oklahoma. He said, my mom and dad have sequestered themselves in an interior closet. But they said they've lost power. Obviously, they can't listen to the radio or the TV. And David, I was just talking to them on my way frantically to get to them, and the phone disconnected. He said, I don't know, David. You need to pray. I prayed. Bonnie prayed. We called John and Aldine Bazzagno. They were praying. And then about 2:30 in the morning, I got that call that no one wants to get. He said, Dad's died. He died in the tornado. And David, it's worse than that. He says, Mom is in a house coat in the pastor's office, and he said the home is destroyed. She's lost every possession she ever had, every picture, every piece of jewelry, every piece of furniture. It's all gone, David. Mom is left by herself. I have to tell you, I cried almost all the way to Oklahoma City. Just the thought, I mean, I knew where my dad was, but just the thought of my poor little mom being left alone in the world without anything that she held dear other than maybe Phil and I and Cheryl. And I cried for her. I wept for her. She hugged me when I got there, and she said, David, it's going to be okay. God is faithful. And that meant so much to me, that my mom was trusting in the promises of God, not just on her scattered possessions to the four winds. During that time, I have to tell you, the family of God rallied together. And although you can't replace these things, they really made it easier. I had a family that said, David, I know your family's coming in from Atlanta and West Palm Beach for the funeral. We just want to pay for all their hotel expenses. Someone else said, we want to get clothes for your mom. Someone else said, we want to give her a place to live. And when the family of God rallies together, it doesn't change the grief that you feel, but it helps you to know, I'm not in this by myself. You should be proud of Southern Baptist, our affiliation with that denomination, and especially with the North American Mission Board right now. Many people don't realize that we have the third largest disaster relief agency in the world. We provide 90% of the volunteers at disaster sites, And right now, yellow-shirted disaster relief volunteers from several different states are in Joplin, Missouri. They're in Tuscaloosa, Alabama. They're giving out food. I serve as a trustee for the North American Mission Board, and Pastor Greg wanted me to mention that this year already, there have been more deaths in tornadoes than in any years in the past 60. The Joplin, Missouri already is the largest cost of life in our nation's history. These are very, very serious times, and already we have provided over 300,000 hot meals, 17,000 volunteer days. Best of all, in the midst of tragedy, have presented the gospel almost 500 times and seen scores of people come to Christ. Many of you have asked, how can we help? And if you've gone to our website the last couple of days, you've seen on the front page a link that you can give directly to disaster relief, tornado relief. We will simply gather the money, send it on to the North American Mission Board. It'll be used to buy food and medicine and need things for the people in these devastated areas. I talked to our chief financial office at NAM on Friday, and he said, David, he said, the need has never been greater. He said, I told him we were going to take an offering this morning. And he said, the need has never been greater and the resources fewer. He said, I'll be praying for you and listening to you on the webcast as you talk about this. So I encourage you, if the Lord lays on your heart, if you note your check, tornado relief or disaster relief, if you put that on the envelope, there'll be ushers at the exits as you leave with little white buckets. Every dime that we collect, none will stay here at First Baptist. It'll all go to help the victims of tornadoes. And as one who saw it up close and personal, I can tell you there's nothing you could do right now other than prayer that would mean more to them than partner alongside in the Christian community to help out. You can give online, you can drop it in any of the little offering receptacles and just put disaster relief on there. Pastor Greg will be mentioning this again next Sunday, but it's a time right now that we need to step up and help our brothers and sisters around the country in areas that are devastated. Life, death breaks in. It reminds you of your own mortality. It reminds you that you are not in control. We try to build walls. We try to wall out trouble. We have security alarms. We have all these sorts of things, and we get upset when they don't work. I heard about a little village, fishing village in Japan that was devastated by a tsunami in 1896 and again in 1933. And they said, never again. We are going to prevent this from happening. So they built a 1.5-mile tsunami wall. It was so large at the base that when it rose up to 30 feet, you could drive a car across the top of it. When the tsunami came earlier this year, people actually got lawn chairs out on top of the tsunami wall and were going to watch the futile waves breaking against their wall because they were absolutely sure they had walled out trouble. Other places may have a problem, but not us. We are secure behind our wall. I want you to see a brief video of the results of that.
A huge fortress-like seawall failed to prevent the March 11th tsunami from sweeping away one Japanese fishing town. An elderly resident describes what happened when the tsunami struck.
The district of Taro in Japan's Iwate Prefecture was protected by a seawall stretching for 1.5 miles and rising up to 10 meters. Even so, the massive tsunami triggered by the magnitude 9 earthquake earlier this month devastated the town, leaving houses wedged against the sea walls and others washed away. Living above where the disaster struck, 63-year-old Mitsuku Fujisawa watched from her balcony as the town was destroyed.
I watched everything from over there. That tsunami came over the sea walls. On the other side of the sea wall, there used to be a fish shop, this huge yellow building which came floating this way. So I shouted, it's no good to be here, and ran further up the mountain.
Following a massive tsunami in 1896 that killed nearly 2,000, the town's inhabitants believed their new sea walls could withstand the worst waves imaginable.
I've heard there were people who didn't think that a wave this big would come and were just sitting in their houses having tea. They must have thought that the wave couldn't go over the walls. There were people still in their houses, you know.
Hundreds are still missing in the small fishing town, and almost all the boats destroyed. Fujisawa worries the town may never recover, as it consists mainly of elderly people, and the cost to rebuild will be enormous. The earthquake and tsunami left at least 28,000 people dead or missing across northeastern towns and cities. About 250,000 people are living in shelters, and the total damage caused could top $300 billion, making it the world's costliest natural disaster.
What a symbol of our attempts to wall out trouble. And then we're shocked when trouble comes to camp on our doorstep. Jesus said, in this life you will have trouble, but be of good cheer. I, Jesus, have overcome the world. How do people deal with trouble when it comes? How do Christians deal with trouble in this world? Mr. Ed Hendy, who is owner with his wife Nina of the Taste of Texas restaurant and a popular talk show host, spoke to our staff at our staff retreat earlier in May. He talked to us about Christian service and Christian excellence. He also, in response to a question, talked about the death of their 30-something son who died unexpectedly. Father, husband, military service, tremendous businessman. The son was taken away from them in a moment. And I remember Ed saying, you know, trying to deal with grief and shock in a moment like this, I don't need a book. Don't give me a book. I need a hug. I need people there from the Christian community that can come alongside and pray for me. Less than a week later, I went to the Holy Land, Israel, with Dr. and Mrs. Glenn Ginter, Glenn and Melinda. And it was eerie that as he shared their story, it was almost the same thing, that a 30-something son, very successful in business, was taken out of their lives in a sudden accident. I remember that Thanksgiving weekend, being over at their house, and the whole Morris family was there to comfort them and help them. But just the shock and the grief. And I said, Glenn, how did you get through that? He said, I read books that people gave me, Christian books on heaven and the sovereignty of God and the love of God. And he said, I literally read myself out of grief. Two very different reactions to a very similar tragedy in life. We can't ultimately wall out trouble, but 2 Corinthians 1 says God is faithful. He said he's the God of all comfort, and with the comfort we've been given, we'll comfort others. God will meet us where we are and help us overcome the shock and the grief of sudden death. The disciples were dispirited, but ultimately change the world. The second thing that I've got in the listening guide that I want to bring your attention to is that death often has impact far beyond our limited understanding. That statement that Caiaphas makes, it's better for you that one man die for the people than that the whole nation perish, is the clearest statement of the substitutionary nature of the atonement of Jesus Christ by a non-believer ever. He ironically states the truth of the gospel, as John points out. So he didn't know what he was saying, but as the high priest, God spoke through him and described the nature of Jesus' sacrifice. What did John write? For God so loved the world that he gave his only begotten son, that whosoever believes in him should not perish. He said it's better that one man perish so that we not perish. It's interesting that the wording Caiaphas used, it's better for you, literally, that can be interpreted, it's more profitable for you. Because you see, Caiaphas was a rich man. The Sadducees, the priestly class, controlled the temple. And so all the sacrifices that came into the temple, they had to ascertain that they were without spot or blemish. And it's kind of like Josephus said, over 250,000 animals were sacrificed at one Passover. And every one of those animals that was brought by somebody else, one of the Sadducees had to say, I see a spot there. You're going to have to buy one of ours. And those animals sold by the priestly class were at greatly inflated prices. There's even evidence that they would sell a worshiper an animal to sacrifice. The priest would lead the animal back behind the altar. After the worshiper was gone, they would lead the same animal back and sell it again. It's why Jesus acted so angrily and called it a den of robbers. He said, this is a house of prayer. He overturned their money table, in which they were charging exorbitant prices. He ran away their sheep, in which they were charging exorbitant prices. But Jesus said, you've made it a den of robbers. And who was profiting by that? Caiaphas. Caiaphas, the collaborator. Caiaphas, the high priest. Caiaphas, who literally was in partnership with the Romans, keeping the Jewish people under his thumb so he could live in a big house. In fact, I have a picture of the house. I took it in Israel last week. There you have the statue of Peter talking to the maid, denying Jesus. You see the rooster up there crowing on the pillar. Throughout this And they're pretty sure this was his house. I mean, it's a mansion. It was on four levels. He had his own prison, had his own dungeon, had his own meeting hall. They had the trial right there in his living room. Caiaphas was a very, very rich man. And so he plotted treachery. He saw the death of Jesus Christ as treachery. And he said, look, coldly, calculatedly, we need to kill this guy because it's more profitable for us. And you know, that kind of struck me because I think, do I ever do that in my own life? Do I ever say, okay, Jesus, this far, but no more? Because I've got a nice little area of my life I don't want you treading on. I kind of like my life the way it is, like where I live, like what my family's doing. I don't want you getting messed up in this. And that's exactly what Caiaphas said. He said, we're going to kill this guy so that we can profit. But for the disciples, it was not treachery, it was tragedy. And we've seen how they were dispirited and overcome with shock at the death of Jesus. But let me submit to you this morning that Jesus' death was neither treachery nor tragedy. It was God's triumph. You see, God ordained that Jesus would die. One man dies so the whole nation would not perish. You see, because heaven is in fact a free gift. Paul wrote, for by grace are you saved through faith. That's not of yourselves. It's a gift of God. Not of works, lest anyone should boast. Because we, in fact, are all sinners. You see, they put a death sentence on Jesus, but we're all under a death sentence. Yeah, my dad went on to heaven. Sons and daughters have gone on to heaven. And yet we want to keep that at arm's length and pretend like we're never going to die. But we are. We're under a death sentence. It's the death rate of humanity is 100%. So we have to be able to face that and realize that we're sinners and the wages of sin is death. You see, God loves us and doesn't want to punish us, but he's just and he must punish sin. So he sent Jesus Christ, the one man who would perish, to die on a cross, to pay the penalty for sin. And he's alive today in heaven to show that he's purchased a place which he offers to us as a free gift. And the gift has to be received by faith. You're not going to go to heaven because you're born in a Christian family. You're not going to go to heaven because you're born in a Christian nation. You don't become a Christian by being born in a Christian family even any more than you would become a Ford by being born in a garage or a biscuit by being born in an oven. God doesn't have grandchildren. He has children. And the Bible says we profess our faith in him by faith and accept his free gift of eternal life. There has to be this personal transfer of trust. We're going to have an invitation in a moment. If you have any doubt at all about that in your own life, have I ever transferred my trust to the one man who perished so that I could live? Have I done that? Do I have a doubt about that? We want to talk to you. That, in many ways, is the reason we exist, is to help people understand that basic truth of theology. And here it was expanded by a non-believer, Caiaphas. A life has a lot of impact beyond our limited understanding. It certainly was the case with Jesus. I think it's in the case of many believers. When a person dies, oftentimes we just see shock and grief. But God can use that in greater ways than we can understand. Such would be the case with Sergeant Brian T. Craig. Sergeant Craig, Staff Sergeant Craig, U.S. Army Explosive Ordnance Disposal, was the son of our pastor of our Woodhaven Deaf Church, Arthur Craig, and his wife Barbara. 27 years old, right after we got involved in Afghanistan, we were chasing the Taliban up into Tora Bora. They were abandoning camp after camp. The EOD specialists would come in and disarm the munitions. And Brian and four other service people were disarming this cache of Al-Qaeda weapons when a booby-trap bomb exploded and killed all five of them instantly. Brian's name appears on a memorial wall at Eglin Air Force Base, and for the past 8 years, Arthur and Barbara have gone to that memorial wall to see their son's name that was added in 2003. I remember visiting their home shortly after I heard the news. The whole street was lined with American flags. Posters were put up in support of the Craig family. Brian was one of the very first killed in the Afghan conflict. And I remember just the overwhelming sense of loss and grief and shock that this 27-year-old man in the prime of his life would be taken away. My limited understanding didn't realize what God was going to do with that. Brian wrote a letter that the Craigs received 12 days after they were notified of his death. And in the letter, he told how God had brought him to Afghanistan to become closer to God, understand more of what God was doing, how he had had an impact on others' lives. It's a beautifully written letter. That letter now appears online. It's been read from coast to coast. Richard Petty, the stock car driver, NASCAR driver, said what an impact that letter had had on his life. A millionaire emailed Arthur from Las Vegas and told what an impact that it had on his life. An evangelist said he uses it everywhere he goes. The Woodhaven Deaf Church has actually set up a nonprofit outreach organization called the Staff Sergeant Brian T. Craig Memorial Fund and Memorial Service. And Arthur and Barbara, Arthur's been named the civilian chaplain for all EOD families across the nation in ministering to their loss. It's opened door after door after door of sharing the gospel. Oftentimes, we ask why. You know, that's the one thing we want to know. But in the case of Dr. Ginter, in the case of Ed and Nina Henley, in the case of Melinda Ginter and Arthur and Barbara Craig, they were saying not why, but what now? How, okay, this has happened. This is not good. But how is God going to use that in our lives? How are we to react to this in this nation? The impact of death goes far beyond our limited understanding. The last thing in closing is while death is inevitable, we attempt to prolong life. It's human nature. A guy was at a revival service in a rural church, and the preacher says, "How many of you want to go to heaven?" Everybody raised their hand except this visitor. He obviously wasn't part of the club, you know. And so the preacher thought he misunderstood, and he goes, "No." He said, "How many of you all want to join me in glory?" And everybody raised their hand except this visitor. And so the preacher called him out, and he says, "Son, don't you want to go to heaven?" He goes, "I absolutely do. I thought you were getting up a group right now." And that's the tension that we have in our lives. There's a difference between God's will. I mean, there's a nuance here between God's will and God's timing. God's will is it's appointed unto man once to die. We all kind of intellectually get that. We like heaven. We like the concept. But we're not anxious to get there because it's God's timing. Every day you wake up is a reminder God's not through with you yet. He's got some purpose for you to still be here on this earth. And so the question is not why. The question is, what now? The question is not to react in bitterness and grief to circumstances, but to react to God's plan for your life. We just got back from Israel on last Sunday, and I had so many emails from people saying, "Are you okay? We're hearing stuff on the news. People are getting shot and killed over there. Is everything okay?" I can just tell you, we never felt safer, you know? You're surrounded by people with M16s. I mean, you just feel like... You know, and so we're just playing tourists, you know. I mean, the day after the incident on the Golan Heights where four people were shot and dozens were wounded, four people were killed and dozens were wounded, our bus went up there within a half mile of that checkpoint. And, I mean, we're getting off the bus, we're taking pictures, we're pointing out things, you know, we're just tourists. And then all of a sudden an Israeli Defense Force vehicle pulls up with heavily armed soldiers, gets out on the same ridge we were. We got a picture of it up here. And they have a different mindset than we had. They're pointing at the same landscape. They're eyeballing the same thing. But as tourists, we were looking for, you know, maybe inspiration or entertainment. They've got a pact with death. Any person that serves their country in the military services, they make a pact with death and say, "I am ready to die for my country." It's the difference between community and cause in the church. I think the church in North America, unfortunately, is filled with a lot of tourists. I think people are kind of coming on Sunday morning, and what's going to be the new song, and are we going to have a new deal going on, and am I going to be inspired? Am I going to take away something that I can kind of put in my spiritual scrapbook? But a soldier says, "I'm ready to die for something that's very important to me." We send out mission teams all over the world. Some of those are pretty dangerous places. And I think every person that goes out on a mission trip needs to understand we don't put God to a foolish test. We take every safeguard we can. And generally speaking, everything is really safe. But if someone goes over on a mission trip and is killed in the process of sharing Christ with a needy world, where is the tragedy in that? You see, a soldier dies because they know the cause is much greater than anything they can do here on earth. And so when a young person dies in service to a cause and goes to heaven, that's not a tragedy. That is a coronation. That is a celebration. Now again, we're not trying to get up a group to go today. Don't, you know, settle back in your chairs. But I think the Church of Jesus Christ in North America needs to have more of a military mindset. We are soldiers who endure conflict. We put on the full armor of God. Jesus said, if anyone would come after me, let them take up their cross. You only take up a cross for one thing. Back in those days, it was to die. And so when we think of the hereafter, there are a lot bigger issues than oftentimes we think of in cultural North America. It's not a matter about walling out all trouble. It is about being called to God's purpose. It's not about avoiding any mention of death. It's about understanding that death is a pathway to heaven and closer fellowship with God. We see a Brian Craig. We see the Ginter son. We see the Hindi son. We see Carol Lewis's daughter taken away in an instant. And yet we say God can use that to impact so many people. The question again is not why. Why did God take my child? Why did God take my dad? That's not the question that's really appropriate. The question is what now? What does God want me to do now? Many of you know the people that were leading our group to Israel. Jim and Wanda Jean Hickey had taken 36 other trips to Israel. We were really excited about going with them. And on the very day that we were going to head out and go to Israel, well, let me back up. A year ago this month, we set the date for the Israel trip. In October of last fall, Jim Hickey was diagnosed with ALS, Lou Gehrig's disease. And since then, every procedure, every doctor, the encouraging thing had been, we're going to get Jim ready to go to Israel in May. That's the target thing. That's the goal. He actually went, he and Wanda Jean went in March and went with our youth. But May was the goal. We wanted to hold out till May. And Dr. Ginter went by to pick up Jim on the day we were departing, loaded up their suitcases that were packed, and Jim had to say, I can't do it. I simply don't have the strength to do it. So instead of going on a trip to Israel, Jim and Wanda Jean checked into Methodist Hospital, and there they have remained since March the 9th through surgery, through trial, through tribulation. And I went by to see them Thursday, and I said I was going to be speaking on the concept of death and the hereafter. And I said I'd like to use a poem, Wanda Jean, that you wrote about promises. And she said, absolutely, you can use us, use our story, use my name. And she said, David, we understand that at any moment God could take us on to be with him. We totally get that. We simply want to be used to glorify him. Wanda Jean wrote, God always keeps his promise for all who will believe. We simply have to claim them, then we surely will receive. He tells us in this word, the promises are yes, if we'll just accept them, the promises to bless. Each time I see a rainbow painted in the sky, it always reminds me I'm the apple of his eye. Yeah, tornadoes come. Storms come in our life. But after the storm, after the tornado, we need to look for the rainbow.
Thank you for listening to the teaching ministry of Houston's First Baptist Church. We invite you to worship with us anytime you're near. We're located at the corner of I-10 West and the 610 Loop. Visit us online at houstonsfirst.org.